The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Wednesday's attack on the offices of Charlie Hebdo in Paris prompted an outpouring of support from comedians and satirists and humorists from around the world.
Our hearts are with the staff of Charlie Hebdo and their families tonight. I know very few people go into comedy, as an act of courage, mainly because it shouldn't have to be that.
So it is very important tonight that I express that everybody who works at our comedy show, and believe it or not, this is a comedy show, that's what we're trying to do here, all of us are terribly sad for the families of those victims, for the people of France, and for anyone in the world tonight who now has to think twice before making a joke.
Joe Randazzo, former editor of America's fake news source, The Onion, penned an op-ed for MSNBC about the vital role that humor plays in free speech. Satire must always accompany any free society, he wrote. It is an absolute necessity. Even in the most repressive medieval kingdoms, they understood the need for the court jester. But what sets satire apart from other forms of humor? And why has it been such an effective tool for sharing ideas and for challenging the powerful? Here to shed some light on the careful craft of satire is Joe Randazzo. He's a comedian, a writer, and, again, former editor of The Onion. Joe, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, you worked at The Onion between 2006 and 2012. What was your initial response when you heard the news of the massacre at the Paris headquarters of Charlie Hebdo?
Well, insofar as one's able from across the ocean to feel a connection to it, I sort of did because they were stormed during their editorial meeting, and that's something that we did all the time at The Onion, that they continue to do all the time at The Onion, and that journalists and news organizations and publications do every week everywhere. And because it was satirists and cartoonists, it felt as though a lot of the work that I've done, some of my closest friends and colleagues have done and continue to do, and a lot of the ideas that I hold dear were literally murdered that day. And it definitely hurt.
Well, you know, in America, a lot of news sources were saying Charlie Hebdo, it's like The Onion. You know, it's a satirical newspaper, certainly, but satire does come in many different forms. In your mind, what distinguishes Charlie Hebdo from America's satirical giants like The Onion, The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, or even South Park?
I think the thing that differs from place to place and culture to culture is context. France has its own very proud tradition of satirizing politicians, of satirizing people in power, and a very, very proud and seriously taken tradition of secularism. So a lot of the response to the cartoons themselves, even hours after it had happened, which I think is fine and understandable, was a discussion over, were these cartoons racist? Were they inflammatory? Are they offensive? And I think it's hard for me to make a judgment on that and what Charlie Hebdo's role is in society, in French society, because it's a context that I'm not completely familiar or used to. It seems that they were very, very interested in pushing boundaries always and actively inflaming. Mm-hmm. You know, the editor of Charlie Hebdo had been quoted as saying, "Muhammad's not sacred to me. You know, I don't care what people think." And, you know, I know it's been mentioned a lot lately, but they were firebombed in 2011.
Right.
That would have shut down most organizations.
Yeah. Well, you've opened up so many things. I mean, the firebombing of Charlie Hebdo and it being targeted by extremist groups in the past, that never happened to The Onion. And I wonder if there was a kind of a sanction or safety in being in print. You know, why do cartoons elicit such a much stronger response?
Well, there's something raw about caricature that I think also taps into a lot of our fears about the other and our history of racism. You know, you think about depictions of hooked-nosed Jews or black men and women, which were depicted in a cartoon caricature form, which we really do not do in the U.S. anymore. And I think that there's just something visceral about seeing those that makes it less subtle, for sure. And there's also, and I don't really have empirical evidence for this, but I think the idea of political correctness has not exactly settled on Western Europe as much as it has here in America. And I think that's something that, for good or ill, has fundamentally changed our society here in America. And I don't, in a way that I don't think it has in France. And, you know, they have their own issues there with Islamophobia and immigration issues. While we certainly have racial tensions here, it's different.
I'm going to go back to that kind of idea that there are different things that Americans would find funny or politically correct. You know, a lot of Americans might look at the Charlie Hebdo covers of a Muslim and an Orthodox Jew kissing each other passionately, slobberingly, other kinds of images that we look at in America and may not find necessarily even funny. Does satire have to be funny, Joe?
No, it doesn't. I mean, some of the greatest satire is more absurd or sad or sickening than it is necessarily funny. I think it should run the entire gamut and can run the entire gamut, but it does not have to tickle your funny bone to necessarily be effective.
So what is the difference here? You know, Charlie Hebdo has been accused of provocation for provocation's sake. How about The Onion? When you were talking things over, there's this aim to offend.
What I think a satirist tries to do is aim at the right target. And that usually means making sure that victims or powerless or the dispossessed are never at the butt of a joke, that you're aiming your joke at those in power. But I also think there's something very legitimate in inflaming for the sake of inflammation if the ideology that you're inflaming is ignorant or, for lack of a better word, stupid. And this is in no way to say that the ideology of Islam as a whole is stupid, but a belief in a system that promotes violence for the depiction of an individual is very much at odds with a modern society. There's not a place for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did it at The Onion. You know, in America, it's much easier and common for satirists to take aim at right-wing white people. So I remember we wrote an op-ed in the voice of Rush Limbaugh after the Haiti earthquake, in which he had said some horrible thing about Haitians, and we were all very angry about the insensitivity and his continued insensitivity. And we wrote an op-ed in which he basically called himself a monster, and you know, it was written by him and saying that he didn't want to live anymore and didn't have the courage to off himself, and would someone please do it?
Mm-hmm.
And we were concerned that we would be sued. We weren't concerned that we would be shot. But we did it for the sake of inflammation, because the ideas that he was spouting we found so offensive that we wanted to needle those and push those.
What was the reaction to that Rush Limbaugh piece in The Onion?
Well, we never heard anything from Rush Limbaugh, so it was a little bit of relief and it was a little bit of disappointment. I doubt he ever saw it.
I'd love for you to walk us through that kind of process of editorial meetings at The Onion. You know, were there things that you discuss that as an editorial team you just thought, you know, no way, we can't do that? I mean, were there sacred cows, I guess?
There's no sacred cow in a general sense. That's a form of self-censorship that I think is deadly. But it's, you know, it's again the idea of what is the point you're making? The example that I like to use, because it's the clearest in my mind, is we had written a headline and written an article all the way through about, you know, when the Iraq War was sort of in its height and worst, mm-hmm. About a soldier who was fretting all the time that he just knows he's going to be the 4,000th fatality. And we went all the way through the process and we were going to print it. And then it occurred to us that while we felt the satire was solid there, that war and the deaths of American troops had become so commonplace as to be almost banal at this point, we realized that there was going to be a 4,000th fatality. Mm. And when that happened, our joke would retroactively have been at the expense of an individual who was serving his country. And we thought, well, there's no way we can run this. It's once that 4,000th fatality happens, this joke becomes all wrong.
Since the attack on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine in Paris this week, we've been hearing a lot of comparisons with The Onion. We're talking with Joe Randazzo. He's the former editor of The Onion. He's talking with us a little bit about their editorial process and the vitality of satire. Yeah, so it suddenly became personal. Any other topics that you just couldn't touch?
I mean, there's always going to be topics that are sensitive and that are sensitive to the staff as a whole. And we didn't always agree either mm-hmm. on, you know, people did not always agree on what was published. You know, for instance, when the Jerry Sandusky thing came out, you know, there was a lot of sensitivity around re-victimizing the victims or in any way, you know, injuring further that community that was struggling so much with what was going on there. That was almost unbelievably horrible, but all the jokes that The Onion published during that time were at the expense of either Sandusky himself or the power structure that enabled him to keep committing those crimes.
Were you or anyone at The Onion ever threatened while you were there?
Well, there would always be the occasional angry email. We would sometimes get handwritten mail too, usually, but in some sort of weird chicken scratch. Most of these came more from people who I would describe as espousing a kind of right-wing Christian ideology. There's only one time that I, in particular, was threatened, and I happened to answer the phone, and it was somebody who was complaining about an article that we wrote. I don't even recall the exact joke, but it was in support, essentially, of marriage equality. And ridiculing those who were against it. And, you know, he had promised and offered to sodomize me, which I turned down his offer. But he also threatened to, you know, kill my family and all of that. And it actually, once it got to that point, became very scary. And he had called up a few other people randomly at Onion offices and made similar threats and offers. And we did wind up calling the police, but they essentially said, well, there's nothing that we can really do. Mm. So,
what do you think the effect of this attack will be on satire? Emboldening, chilling effect?
Well, I think there's bound to be an initial sort of chilling effect. There's fear, there's anger, there's grief. But the people who committed these acts have really already lost this war of ideas and this proves it. It's a violent and cowardly last resort lashing out against a world that's moving on. And I think this is going to definitely embolden satire. You know, I mean, you think about for all of the talk about the dangers posed by printing images of Muhammad, and you would wonder, well, what is the worst that could happen? And this was it. We've just seen the worst that can happen, and we're going to move on. And a free society has to be able to embrace all ideas, and we will continue to do that. I think hopefully we'll also open up a conversation about Westerners' views of Islamists and Islamic radicals and moderate Muslims and how these depictions may have inflamed people, and continue to talk about how we can have a pluralistic society. But in no way is it going to chill satire. It's only going to make it stronger.
Joe Randazzo, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Randazzo, he's a comedian, he's a writer and former editor of The Onion. And his new book, Funny on Purpose, is coming out in April. And I want to mention he is a native of Penacook, New Hampshire. Any shout-out for New Hampshire there, Joe?
Check out the Hannah Duston Memorial if you get a chance, because it's not going to be around too much longer. I don't think it's crumbling.
Speaking of satire, a link to his op-ed is at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, the world's manliest head of state. how Vladimir Putin uses machismo, sexuality, and gender norms to build political legitimacy in Russia. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When Russian President Vladimir Putin turned 58, 12 female admirers published a calendar of themselves in clothing and poses that could have been found in a Victoria's Secret catalog. How about a third time, read Miss February's caption, a provocative reference to Putin's third presidential run. The well-publicized gift reinforced Putin's magnetic machismo, carefully cultivated through images of the Russian leader subduing wild animals, playing rough sports, fighting fires, and many, many photos of his muscular torso on display. Political scientist Valerie Sperling makes the case that trading on widely familiar ideas about gender and sexuality has been a strategy for Putin to establish political legitimacy. This sexualization of the political realm runs parallel to increasing authoritarianism and nationalism in Russia, which includes oppression of feminists, the LGBT community, and other anti-Kremlin opposition. Valerie Sperling is professor of political science at Clark University and author of the new book, Sex, Politics, and Putin, Political Legitimacy in Russia. And Valerie Sperling, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you point to Putin's displays of masculinity with journalists in tow as part of a strategy of legitimation. Now, why do these images in particular work in today's Russia?
You know, I think this works in today's Russia. I think it resonates with the public because of the political context. You know, you have to remember that Putin comes to power right after the 1990s, and that's when you have the collapse of the Soviet Union, the loss of Russia's superpower status, the loss of communist ideology to the extent that anybody still believed in it. You have the economic collapse after the transition, you know, from communism to capitalism. And Yeltsin, during the 90s, Russia's leader, is seen as having presided over weakening Russia at the hands of the West. So in that context, right, Putin's assertion of masculinity, here we have a strong leader who's going to make Russia strong, he's going to actually re-masculinize Russia, that image, I think, really resonates. Mm-hmm.
You can't kick Russia around anymore, kind of
thing. Exactly.
There are many things at work here, including the significance of showing his dominance over other men. Now, Valerie, is this clear that this is all strategic, or is this just who Putin is, a macho guy?
Yeah. I think most politics is about competition, and so it's going to entail dominating others. And so in that sense, these are strategic choices. It's a choice to put other potential competitors in their place. And sometimes that takes a concrete form. I can give you one example. It's kind of a graphic example. This was a few years ago, a liberal politician, Boris Nemtsov, who was jailed after participating in a protest against the regime in an opposition rally. And then while he was in jail, a pro-Putin youth group, you know, which is at least in some ways sponsored by the Kremlin, right? It went out in Moscow with a petition asking people to have the prosecutor's office investigate charges that Nemtsov had been raped while he was in jail. Right. So now there was no evidence that Nemtsov had been raped in jail or that he had been sexually abused in any way. But what that did was it suggested, right, that maybe Nemtsov hadn't been strong enough to fend off an attack, you know, not manly enough to resist, or maybe even that he had been a willing participant in gay sex, right? So that is how that dominance can play out in this way of impugning, you know, another man's manly reputation. Mm-hmm.
Well, Nashi, one of these pro-Putin groups, is also behind a video that went hyper-viral in Russia in 2011. We'll play a clip from it. It's a 2011 video, 2.5 million hits. And the announcement here is that I'll rip it for Putin. It's announcing a contest.
Достойный политик и шикарный мужчина. Он Владимир Путин. Его обожают миллионы, ему верят. Но есть кучка людей, которые поливают его грязью.
So, Valerie, what's going on in this video?
So in this video, you see this very nicely dressed young woman in stiletto heels, very buxom as well, strolling around in chic areas of Moscow with her iPhone. And what she's doing in the clip, the voiceover that you hear, she's talking about what a wonderful politician and man Putin is. So she goes on like this. She meets up with some of her young, beautiful friends, and they announce a competition called I'll Rip for Putin. And at the end of the clip, what she does, she has a tank top, a white tank top that she's wearing, and she tears it in half. And the clip ends just as she tears it, so you don't actually get to see anything. And at that last moment, the voiceover says, and it's her voice speaking, she says, "What are you prepared to do for your president?"
But opposition groups have been vocal, but I'd like to know how vocal. Is there a politically legitimate feminist voice or party in Russian politics today, and how do they regard Putin?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is definitely a feminist voice in Russia today, but it's a small voice in public. I think that the young feminists that I interviewed, they see Putin and the whole masculinity macho strategy for exactly what it is. Like, he's being portrayed as the alpha male whose leadership can't be questioned. You know, so in other words, they see that machismo and authoritarianism are reinforcing each other. And also, to the extent that the political leader in that paradigm has to be defined as a manly man, that doesn't leave a lot of room in politics for women. And feminists recognize that as well.
Well, there was one opposition group that we heard a lot about, reached international attention. This is the punk rock performance artist group Pussy Riot. Members were arrested a few minutes into performing this punk prayer. Now, this was at the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in Moscow, later sentenced to prison, and later did a bit of a PR run around the United States. Here's just a little clip of the chaos from this original video. They're in dresses and masks, and they're chanting and dancing and genuflecting on the altar. Google Vladimir Putin and you're bound to come up with loads of images of the shirtless Russian leader. Well, we're talking with the political scientist Valerie Sperling, who's done a lot of research on gender norms and the political realm in Russia. Her new book is called Sex, Politics, and Putin. So at the same time that Putin's been kind of pushing this masculinity and its association with being a strong, decisive leader, Russia was becoming a less democratic state, which leads us to one of the major lines of inquiry in your study, that role that sexuality in the political realm plays in democracy. I know it's tough to summarize, but how do you see that fitting in?
Well, I guess we could look at this question in one of two ways. One is, what does using so many gender norms and sexualization do to democracy? In other words, how does it undermine democracy? And the other way to look at it is that this is something that's not unique to Russia, that it enters into other dictatorships, and it also enters into democracies. A difference is that in democracies, right, in places that have a longstanding women's movement, it's not as easy for politicians to succeed on that basis. The United States, even, when Todd Akin in 2012 was running for the Senate, right, the Republican, and he made that awful comment that legitimate rape, you know, would not result in pregnancy, mm-hmm, he lost his race, mm-hmm, because I think the public was well aware that that was not a legitimate thing to say. And by contrast, in 2006, when Putin was speaking to Israel's prime minister, a statement was made which caught the attention of Russian feminists, but they were not really able to bring it to the public's attention. What happened was, at that time, Israel's president had been accused of raping two of the women on his staff. And Putin, he said, "Oh, President Katsav turned out to be a mighty man. He raped 10 women. You know, we all envy him." And apparently, like, both delegations, you know, laughed at this rape joke. And so this was reported, feminists knew about it, but it didn't get any traction as a shameful story in Russia, the way that I suspect something like that would get traction if there was a bigger, stronger feminist movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, now Russia is largely diplomatically isolated. Inflation, low gas prices are really sending the economy into the tank. will we see more of these displays of machismo, you know, the shirtless, decisive Putin that you can rally behind? Does it work anymore?
I think it does continue to work. The worse Russia's position gets, in a way, the stronger Putin's position gets personally. The more endangered Russia is, whether it's being threatened, you know, from the West, you know, with sanctions, trying to undermine Russia, I think the more the Russian regime can point to that, the more they can point to the necessity of Putin as the leader. You know, speaking about sexual metaphors and, you know, and so forth, a couple of weeks ago, Boris Nemtsov, a liberal politician, he was being asked, I think, how is Putin managing to be so popular, even despite, you know, the ruble crashing and the economy being in some dire straits? You know, Putin's still pulling something over 80% approval ratings. And Nemtsov said, using a very sexual metaphor, he said, by taking over the Crimea, Putin found the Russian population's G-spot, and they are prepared to forgive him everything.
Well, I think we have to end there. Valerie Sperling, professor of political science at Clark University and author of the new book, Sex, Politics, and Putin, Political Legitimacy in Russia. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
It was a real pleasure, Virginia.
Now, you'll find more on the book, and you can see some of the many shirtless Putin tumblers. We've got links at wordofmouthradio.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, this song is about a man I really like. He's so cute, he's so strong, and so powerful. This song is about
Vladimir
Putin.
Vladimir
While a shirtless Vladimir Putin signals strength and virility in Russia, here in the U.S., millennial television viewers have been taken in by a different depiction of manhood. For them, Don Draper, the fictional character played by John Hamm in AMC's Mad Men, is the new epitome of masculinity. He's powerful, well-dressed, promiscuous, and enigmatic. Eric Malinsky tries to understand why fans of the show are ready to ditch their T-shirts and jeans for slim-cut suits and ties.
So I was talking to this guy at a bar, Neil Scapora. He's from the Bay Area. He says dude all the time. But when Neil watches the show Mad Men, he wishes he could wear his suit to work.
Dude, I don't have the function for it. That's the bummer. In California, so few people really have a calling to actually wear a formalized suit.
Neil's being modest. His boss instituted a dress code for the whole office just because Neil wore shabby T-shirts. He started wearing collared shirts, but they're always a little subversive, like a rat instead of an alligator. I asked him what would happen if Don Draper was his boss.
He probably would have beaten me in the alley. I would have been like an affront to his manhood. He probably would have just pummeled me with his chin for a while.
Hey, Don, look who's here.
It isn't the man in the gray flannel suit.
What the hell is that for?
Don Draper is nothing like me either. He's reserved while I'm effusive. He's formal. I'm casual. He erased his childhood. I still have my Star Wars action figures. But I also wish I could be more like him. I even started consulting a blog called What Would Don Draper Do?
Well, you'd want advice from this man he seems anointed.
Michael Dempster created the blog. It's a side project. In his day job, he writes for Howard Stern, who is about as far from Don Draper as you can get.
Yeah, my first impulse is always to make a joke about or, you know, transsexuals or something, but never to shut my mouth.
The blog is a lot cleaner. It works more like a Dear Abby column. For instance, someone wrote, Dear Don, I'm considering a long-distance relationship with someone who lives across the country. She's fantastic, but is it worth the distance and expense? Dempster does his best to channel Don Draper.
I like the idea of entering into any relationship with an assumed distance. A comfortable remove is a wise position. Long sounds too far for comfort.
It's interesting the way you, like, furrow your brow.
Well, I squint a little bit, but yeah, it's a very sober attitude that he has, even though he's not really ever sober.
Matt Caldicott is another Don Draper fan. He's jealous of Don's sense of privacy, something we've lost today.
There isn't much mystery in this day and age. I mean, most people can find out just about anything about you by going on Google.
Matt works in Spin, doing PR for internet companies. He says today, there's no way Don could be so secretive and maintain a professional reputation.
He would have to be out all the time. He would have to be on Twitter commenting on industry trends and issues. He'd have to do all sorts of things that, you know, going to sit in a bar after work just really wouldn't do for him.
I asked each of these guys what was the coolest thing Draper ever did. It wasn't the philandering, because we see how destructive that is to his family. It wasn't even the drinking and smoking at the office. It was the fact that at the end of season two, Don went on this business trip to California and disappeared for 3 weeks.
Mr. Draper, you're a sight for sore eyes.
Hello, Joan. It's good to be back.
Do you want to know if you've been missed? That's half your correspondence. Mr. Sterling has been very anxious to speak to you on a daily basis.
Call Roger in a half an hour and tell him I'll meet him in a half an hour. And Mr. Phillips, maybe I'll run into him in the men's room.
I mean, I know of situations where people are actually sending emails that basically say things to the effect of whereabouts. I can't imagine Don sitting down at his desk, sending out a one-line email saying, going to the movies for 3 hours this afternoon. Be back sometime before 5.
I think you're not suited for this job.
What did I do?
In addition to being incompetent, you threatened my reputation, and not just today.
Mr. Draper, I try to cover for you all the time.
You do not cover for me. You manage people's expectations.
Is this not the whitest TV show you've ever seen? You know, there are some massive changes in the workplace of today that are not ever likely to be repeated.
Michael Kimmel is a sociologist. He doesn't think that fans of the show want to go back to a time when white men held power through racism or sexism. But those of us born after 1970 are seeing something very appealing in the workplace of the early 60s. In Don Draper's world, security, status, and stability are easy to obtain. If Don wants to, he could stay at Sterling Cooper for his entire career.
The guys in Mad Men, you know, they have an idea of what they want by the time they're 30, by the time they're 40. And you could ask them. And, you know, Seth Rogen, he can't tell you where he's going to be next week.
You know, the webpage or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
So how do you...
How do I pay rent? When I was in high school, I got ran over by a postal truck. I got like 14 grand.
Kimmel interviewed hundreds of young men for his book, Guyland. They're a lot like Judd Apatow characters. They have big dreams to be a filmmaker or an internet mogul, but they're just not sure how to get there.
The economy is so, it makes you so anxious. It's so tenuous. Any hold you might have can be taken away in an instant.
So they go from job to job, waiting for their big break. They're not boys anymore, but they'll never be men in gray flannel suits.
They're living with a level of anxiety that Don Draper never had to face. That's an infantilizing situation. That is, we're putting them in a situation where it's hard to be grown-ups, and then we're saying, okay, be grown-ups.
Banana Republic now sells Mad Men-style suits. Maybe if guys like me dress like Don Draper, we can feel more like grown-ups. But the great thing about Don Draper is that he secretly wants to escape from his suit. That's why we like him.
If I leave this place, it will not be for more advertising.
What else is there?
I don't know, life being lived.
And our thanks to producer Eric Malinsky for that story. And we'll move from machismo to music. A concert cellist backs off from the traditional gentility of classical music and offers some tough love for the beleaguered genre. Stay with us for that story. That's after the break, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Bankrupt orchestras, aging audiences, declining attendance, skyrocketing conservatory tuition. Classical music in America is in peril. So who's to blame? The record industry? The internet? Pop musicians? Will Roselip has a different idea. He wants to take down classical music's traditional culture. In his book, The Libertine's Guide to the Classical Music Revolution, he outlines why the industry is in crisis and some ideas on how to save it. Will Roselip is a cellist, a media director for the Cambridge Philharmonic, and author of the Classical Dark Arts blog. And Will, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia. Good to be here.
So who did you write this book for? Is it for musicians?
The reason I wrote the book in the first place is because I'd seen, you know, a billion Slate articles about the death of classical music, and I was just getting a little tired of that. I mean, every few months we sort of revisit the topic, and from where I stand, it's very much alive. It's just sort of in a little, we'll call it a recession or a little dip in interest. And it seemed like we need a fresh reboot, just a new pair of eyes to look at things, and I'm not saying that I'm that pair of eyes, But it's sort of common sense that we need to not necessarily reboot it, but we do need to represent it to people and present it in a way that makes sense. Like what a line I use in the book and that I've repeated ad infinitum after that is that classical music doesn't have a seat at the pop culture table. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem because we forget that like people have very short attention spans. And it's really hard to market classical music in that small amount of time. But I think we have to figure out a way not to dumb it down, but just to break off a little piece for people so they can figure out how they get into it.
Well, classical music always has had a reputation for being stuffy or inaccessible, not really having a seat at the pop music table. Is part of the problem the culture of performances themselves, which I think for a lot of people feels prohibitive?
I think so. I think it's a little stuffy. It's been a little too formal for a long time. I was at a concert recently, and I won't say the orchestra, but it was a big orchestra. And as the performer was coming out on stage, I pulled out my phone to take a little video of it. And I felt like I felt like I was a pariah or something for just taking 30 seconds of video to show people what it was like mm-hmm. when this particular performer came out on stage. I'm like, oh. So that's something we really need to work on. I think that making it more comfortable for audiences, everything from like not dressing, we look like penguins up on stage. We've got all the tuxedos and the formal wear, dressed for a funeral or something. I don't know who decided on this dress code, but I think we can just get rid of it. And also, you know, when you look out into the audiences, you have a certain level of dress or decorum or whatever, and people are just kind of scared. They're scared to make noise. You hear a few coughs in between movements, but other than that, you don't really get a lot from the audience except for the obligatory bravos at the end. It would be nice to change that. When Mozart performed some of his new pieces, he wrote a letter, I think, to one of his family members saying, you know, I premiered one of my works and the audience was so loud I had to go back and play it two or three or four more times because they were so into that. That's like the most foreign experience now, and it's kind of a shame. I mean, we really need to do something about it.
Well, I've also noticed that people don't know quite when to clap. Like, they're afraid, oh no, if the movement isn't quite finished, I'm clapping too soon.
It's a little scary, right?
Well, so you're a millennial, you're a cellist. What's going to work then? What will make these orchestral performances and the music a little more accessible?
Well, I don't think it's any one thing necessarily. I can just say anecdotally, when I've performed for a bunch of different things. You know, I've played at weddings and funerals. I've done performances at sort of business organizations and that kind of stuff, on down through orchestral shows and in bars. And the thing that really resonates with people is that you can kind of approach the performers. If you do it in less stuffy settings, like you get into art galleries or you play outdoors or it's like street musicians, whatever, like people feel much more comfortable to just come up, talk to the performer, take in the music, and just, you know, decide how much they want to engage. The problem is, you know, oftentimes we get them into symphony halls and we just close and lock the doors and like, nope, you're not moving for an hour and a half. And if you do, then you've just broken protocol. You'll be banished for life. So I think we need to, you know, you make it a little more comfortable for people, serve them alcohol, let them drink alcohol while they're listening, or even water, you know, just something that basic. And one of the groups that I talk about a lot is Group Muse, which is this new thing in Boston. I think it's in New York now, too, where it stages shows in people's living rooms. And this is kind of a genius idea because everybody's just kind of sitting around, they're having snacks, they're drinking a beer, and in between pieces, the performer talks to the audience like a normal human being, not like some alien up on stage, describes the piece, why she likes playing this piece, etc. So it's a really interesting concept, and I think one that more orchestras and more performers would do well to emulate.
You also advocate for smaller orchestras, slimmed down school curricula, reasonable expectations for audience interest. But let's look at this, Will. I mean, symphony orchestras are definitely in trouble. In 2011, the Philadelphia Orchestra declared bankruptcy. There have been strikes and lockouts in Minnesota, Atlanta. It suggests that something is really wrong. So what do you do with these kind of big structural problems? You're talking about, you know, kind of rebuilding a whole ecosystem here.
Yeah, it's kind of daunting. I don't necessarily have the answer to this question, but I will say in the book that I was advocating for smaller groups, sort of a more of a startup mentality where you just do as bare bones as possible in order to generate interest, to generate a set of core fans, you know, the diehards who are going to come to every show. Mm-hmm. They retweet every tweet that your orchestra sends out. They like everything on Facebook. That kind of approach may help. I think when you're talking about bigger orchestras, it's a little bit more of a conundrum. I think that adventurousness in programming is one great area to start, not necessarily always programming in a way where, you know, you do your overture to start off with, then you do the concerto, then you take a nice little respite, a little intermission, then come back and you do the big symphony or whatever. Like, you know, there's some room to experiment in there. And I think people will really respect orchestras, not only that don't pander to the same kinds of things that have always worked, but who have their audience in mind and want to try something new. And I think they'll respond if they see that the orchestra is taking some risks. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, oh, wow, you know.
When you're talking, I was thinking smaller orchestras, smaller performance halls, kind of limits the repertoire. But is that the point, to get off of the kind of greatest hits bandwagon, I guess, you know, play new composers?
That would be nice, yeah. And you see a lot of new composers write for really unusual ensembles and a lot of smaller stuff. The full orchestra is always will be the sort of Dolby 5.1 surround sound experience. It is the 24-karat experience for classical music. There won't ever be a replacement for that. I mean, when we look at big occasions, you know, heads of state who pass away for the Olympics, whatever, you see tremendously large orchestras, and there's a reason for that, because it's a lot of sound, and it's fascinating to watch players like that. But it's not the only way that you can present classical music. There are many other ways. And there's nothing stopping an orchestra, like here we have the Boston Symphony. There's nothing stopping the Boston Symphony from also doing breakout shows, from doing shows off campus, hopefully, you know, in communities of color, reaching out to people who don't normally go to classical shows. You don't have to have the full symphony on stage every night of the week.
But does the audience really want to hear new composers? I mean, looking at classical music sales and what's popular, it looks like a lot of retread.
There are some people who just like to go and hear the hits, and I totally get that. I love the hits. I love Beethoven above almost all other composers. But at the same time, I think they're willing to go along for the ride. You look at a composer like John Luther Adams. He has a new piece out called Become Ocean, which was recorded by the Seattle Symphony. And this, I mean, this is a really fascinating piece. You know, he probably wrote it last year or 2013 or something like that. And you can tell by reviews of the orchestra's playing, by reviews of the CD, that he's really taking some risks, but also, like, connecting with some of the core stuff, like the moments of big feeling that the audience wants to hear still. So that's, I mean, there's promise in moments and in composers and pieces like that. We have to be driving towards that. But yeah, it's a fine balance between the classics and some of the newer stuff.
Let's pause and hear a little bit of John Luther Adams' composition, Become Ocean. Well, it seems we've been hearing that classical music is dead for a long time. Will Roslip begs to differ. He says we have to find new ways to play, perform, and experience classical music. His new book is called The Libertine's Guide to the Classical Music Revolution. Classical music tastes are also shaped by what we hear on classical music radio. So what role do stations play in this, and what changes would you like to hear?
I would like to hear more stations, more classical DJs or whatever you want to call them, be like Funkmaster Flex. I said this in the book where he's sitting in.
Let's just clarify. He's on Hot 97. That's a New York station, hip hop station.
Yes. Yeah. Hip hop DJ. And he's been doing it for years and years. And the fascinating thing about him is that he's not just lining up a playlist. It's not like, you know, just turning on Spotify and walking away for 3 hours. He's toying with listeners. He's playing pieces for them. He's giving them little snippets. If he's got a premiere, like a new Beyonce track, he's not going to give you the whole thing. He's just going to give you like 15 seconds of the beat and stop. And he'll play the little record scratch thing, you know, and then stop everything dead in its tracks and be like, yeah, it's great. But if you want to hear the whole thing, you got to come back later. And just keep doing that, and just tantalizes the audience, and it's genius. I'd like to hear more of that. I know that some stations are heading more towards a movement by movement performance rather than playing complete works, because it's a little less for the audience to digest at one time. I'm of two minds on that, because it's nice to be able to carve up things the way you want to carve them up. But on the other side, you do want to, you know, it is good to hear stuff in its entirety, the way the composer wrote it. But I think any composer would just be relieved that we're playing her or his music today, you know, maybe 100 or 200 years after the piece was written.
Right. Well, the music industry has changed dramatically for everybody, especially those in the middle ground, not those on top of the food chain. I mean, Katy Perry and Taylor Swift and Pharrell are still doing just fine. But everyone's trying to figure out this new model. Can it be applied to classical music?
I think so. I think it's sort of a trial and error approach to this. Yeah, the Katy Perrys of the world, the Taylor Swifts, whoever, are always going to be playing the Super Bowl halftime show. There's no way around that because people like a show and you have to have somebody to slot in there. But on down the line from them, basically we've got smaller, more independent artists who may or may not have a label affiliation, who are doing their own sort of marketing. And this goes back to the core set of fans, the ones who really like your work, who are almost going to be doing some of your marketing for you. They feel passionate enough about this new release that they're just going to jump all over it. There's a rapper named Joey Bad who's out of New York City, and I know he has a release in a week or 2 weeks. And I'm tweeting this out to all my friends and messaging them, like, you have to hear this when it comes out. And that's the sort of model or approach that I think classical music has to go to as well. You know, you have people on a mailing list or whatever, and they say, and you just talk to them and say, we could really use some help with this. If you want to tell your friends about it, you know, here's all the information you're going to need to promote this. And it's not a guaranteed thing. Unfortunately, the days of making the most money off of album sales are probably over. But you can still do well on merch. You can still do well on ticket sales, on getting people to come out and support Kickstarter, things like that. So I think it's a combination of those things that are going to be the answer. There's not one silver bullet at this time.
Well, I feel like we've had a little bit of a pep talk, Will. Thank you.
I'm glad you feel that way. Thanks, Virginia. It was fun.
Will Roslip is a cellist. He's also media director for the Cambridge Philharmonic and a producer at WGBH Radio. There's a link to look at his new book. There's a link to his new book, The Libertine's Guide to the Classical Music Revolution, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from you. Is classical music dead? Do you listen to it? Do your kids listen to it? Do you shell out money to buy CDs or attend performances? You can join in the discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Among the issues in contemporary classical music that we didn't talk about during that conversation is the gender gap. While you will find a lot of women playing in orchestras, you won't find many of them on the conductor's podium. In this piece, producer Sarah Elzis profiles a Paris-based American conductor who's fought sexism throughout her career.
Orchestral conducting in particular has been one of the most traditionalist and conservative jobs that I know of. We have the weight of our history of the art, which was exclusively male for such a long time. And then we have also the reality, which was that before the women's rights movement, I mean, before the 20th century, no woman could be in a position of power. So we're dealing with two types of very slow-moving progress. My name is Elizabeth Askren Bree. I work as a freelance conductor. I am a native New Yorker, and I've been based in Paris for the last 16 years. You can't be wishy-washy. If you're coming to meet an orchestra for the first time, then you have to get to know them. They have to get to know you. I mean, it's a dance, and you have very little time. With orchestras, you might get 3 services, maybe 4, and each service could be 2.5 to 3 hours. So that's really not much at all if you're doing a full-length program, but that's completely standard. So you really have to be extremely efficient. You've got to get right to the meat of the matter to build a collective interpretation of the pieces that you're going to play. I had my first experience conducting when I was 16. I was very intrigued that you could indirectly influence with a series of movements that kind of combine sport and dance and physical architecture, and you can transmit that to other musicians who would interpret that and create music in a certain way. I was really lucky because there was a teacher who was a conductor, Rebecca Scott, and she saw something in me that she wanted to encourage. She and another professor really gave me those first opportunities where somebody in the profession said, you know, you could do this. Traditionally, in musical circles, you know, you transmit your energy and your vision to the next generation, but you choose somebody because you feel that affinity. So if you don't have somebody who can naturally see that in you, then you have to work extra hard to show them that despite this very apparent difference, that you can go past that. There are definitely moments of I'm hanging it up or I could do something else. I'm not quite sure that it was directly because of a comment, a sexist comment, but just because of the general difficulty. I mean, it is almost insurmountable sometimes. This profession is extremely difficult for anybody. There are so few posts, and I think it's a slippery slope to go on to always say, oh, poor me, it's because, you know, I'm this, or that because they didn't allow me to. It may or may not be the case, but that's not helpful in getting where you want to be. Everybody has a different way of coming to terms with the fact that you're a minority in your professional setting, but I like to think that you can't avoid it. You're different. But then once you've accepted it and you say, yeah, that's right, I'm a woman, I have maybe a different body language or whatever it is, then you just get past it and you say, I'm here to make music. And I have very rarely had problems with the musicians in the orchestra because it is about the music making, and the musicians know that.
And that profile of Elizabeth Askren Bree was produced by Sarah Elzis for Radio France International. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. You never know what gets passed around on Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us next time for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.